Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue. As today we talk about the current and future role of CD20, CD3 bispecific antibodies in the management of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, particularly follicular cell lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Martin Hutchings from the University of Copenhagen in Copenhagen, Denmark, and Dr. Loretta Nostafal from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. We also recruited several other investigators to take a survey about their thoughts about bispecifics, and we'll talk about that later on in the program. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. And as we do in all our webinars, there's a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey that we recommend for you to take. It's in the chat room. Next week, we're going to be doing a program on metastatic pancreatic cancer. We'll talk about new data from NALIRIFOX and whether or not that's going to be new first-line therapy. Then on Thursday, August the 10th, we'll work with Professor Georgina Long in Australia, talk about melanoma and all the new immunological approaches to that disease. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars and the replays of our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program on the management of lymphomas with Dr. Flynn. So today we're going to be talking about bispecifics. We had a recent program where we talked about bispecifics in myeloma. This has the same format. I met with both of our faculty separately in the last couple weeks to record their presentations. Dr. Nassafel focused on bispecifics and follicular lymphoma. We're going to start out in the first half of this program and review some of the things she talked about. And Dr. Hutchings talked about bispecifics and diffuse large B-cell and in the second half of the program. But I really recommend that you check out. They're in the these presentations. They're in the chat room. We're going to send out an email soon with this webinar link on it, as well as both of these presentations. I highly recommend these presentations, and hold on to your hats. This is going to be the quickest hour you've ever had. These are some of the data sets that the faculty reviewed in their presentations. They also went through their cases. We spent like 20, 30 minutes just on their cases. So really great sessions. We're going to sort of pick up and talk about first follicular lymphoma, first some of the sort of concepts that Loretta got into. We'll see what Martin has to say about that as well. I will also talk about some cases of patients Loretta's taken care of, and then finally the faculty survey. So first, you know, it's maybe sort of a simple, we have so many bispecifics now in oncology, Loretta, you sort of can kind of take it for granted about how they work, but I know it can't be as simple as they've been telling us. So I'm going to give each one of you, both of you had some thoughts about this in your presentation. I'm going to give each one of you an opportunity to sort of talk about how you envision the way these agents work. Loretta, how do you see this?
So this is building off the concept of rituximab, for instance, where we know targeting CD20, particularly in follicular lymphoma, has been quite an effective strategy for the last two decades. So building off of that construct, they're just adding in a second target, and that second target is CD3, which helps engage and recruit endogenous T cells. We know that it's quite good at activating those T cells, potentially even more super physiologic activation of those T cells. So we hope by that sort of close proximity and activation, you're engaging the patient's own T cells to eradicate their malignant B cells or any cells that have CD20 on the surface.
Can you talk a little bit about the agents that we're going to be talking about today and more, and how they're built, so to speak, and the differences, at least in terms of the way they're constructed, Loretta?
Yeah, and I think, you know, anyone who's been treating patients with leukemia for the last few years is probably familiar with blinatumomab, which is a bite. One of the limitations is the very short half-life that does require the continuous infusion. So with the real advantage to these bispecifics, you're mostly built off of the IgG backbone, so it lends itself to longer half-life, therefore less frequent dosing intervals. Mosunetuzumab essentially has the backbone of rituximab, and then again, second arm targeting CD3. epcoritamab is a little different in that the Fc region is not silent like it is for mosunetuzumab and glofitamab. So you could then potentially partner it with something like with rituximab and have some additive activity. And then glofitamab, you have a 2-to-1 configuration of 2-to-1 targeting of CD20 to CD3. And so those are some of the unique features of the constructs, the ones we're going to spend most of the time talking about.
So, Martin, I'm curious, so we'll get to the graphics you showed and your view of it, but I'm just kind of curious, looking at what we're seeing here right now in terms of how these are constructed, how you, particularly over on the left side where you have the four agents that I think we're talking the most about today, how do you, and, you know, talking to the two of you, I kind of realize it's not as simple as you kind of think. What's your vision about this, particularly in terms of efficacy? You know, we already have heard and we see that mosun is approved in follicular lymphoma, but we see differential effects and that EPCO and glofitamab seem to be more used in diffuse large B-cell. But can you talk a little bit more about how you envision sort of the activity of these agents and also how much CRS you're going to see with these agents, Martin?
So they are different. They have differences. Loretta pointed out some important ones. Also, they had different binding sites, some of them for CD20 and for CD3 on the T-cell receptor complex. But whether these differences in fact explain the differences that we see in efficacy and in toxicity profiles, I can't be sure. So the teams behind the glofitamab, for example, put a lot of weight on the 2-to-1 format, which brings about a higher affinity of that drug. Whether that is responsible for a higher activity in the end, can't be sure. But they have certain differences. I would, though, echo what Loretta said. They have much more in common than they have than the differences. And the important thing is the IgG-based structure, given a high stability in the vial, in the bloodstream, and a pretty long half-life, typically counted in almost a week.
So, Loretta, as I was mentioning, you know, we try to get to more macro views of these. If anyone wants to get into the details of the trials and the data, they should check out your presentations. But I just wanted to chat with you rather than show you a bunch of slides from your talk about your vision. And when you look at these agents, how, in your mind, how you compare efficacy and toxicity, particularly in the setting of FL, you know, patients with more indolent disease where you don't want to get them too sick. So when you think about the agents that we've just talked about, how would you compare sort of their efficacy and tolerability, particularly from the point of view of CRS? And why is it that, at least at this point, mosunetuzumab is the only one that's approved?
Yeah, great discussion. And I think, you know, it's easy for me to focus on mosunetuzumab because that is the only one that's FDA approved currently that we have, you know, real world experience with in the U.S. We participated in the study. So even my clinical experience is predominantly formulated by my experience with mosunetuzumab. I do think it has a very easy to use safety profile. And what I mean by that is all these patients in the last few years in our center have been managed outpatient. The dose ramp up is pretty easy to follow. You do see cytokine release syndrome. It's one of the most common side effects we see, but it's very manageable. And so what I mean by that, it's something that can be managed with Tylenol oftentimes, low dose dexamethasone if you're worried about patients. And I can kind of walk through some of the situations where we've done that in the clinic. And very few patients need a dose reduction or interruption as a result of toxicity. And no patients on the study died as a result of toxicity that was directly related to mosunetuzumab. And so for those reasons, I think the efficacy is attractive. 60% of patients have a CR. It looks to be durable now with a median PFS of about 2 years. And this was in pretty heavily pretreated patients that had progressed following alkylators and CD20 antibodies. And so we can at least conclude that you can still effectively target CD20 with this. You're going to get the efficacy that we typically see with chemotherapy-like approaches, but it's going to have a very manageable safety profile, and you're going to be able to keep people on it.
And here's Loretta's summary of this. The other agent that you talked about, that to me looks similar in terms of outcomes, is odronextamab. Can you kind of contrast these two agents, particularly specifically in FL?
Yes, and I do think you're going to see far more similarities than differences. I think one of the things that the study team learned with odronextamab is they needed to go back and revisit their dose step up. And so, and that was because of, again, acute toxicity in the form of CRS. And so with a much more conservative dose step up, we're splitting the dose over 2 days, low dose week one, a little bit higher dose week two, and then finally getting to your full dose. With those approaches, the toxicity, again, looks to be quite comparable to what you see with mosunetuzumab. This study, the single arm phase two, they did dose until progression, whereas with mosin, the most you would get was 17 cycles. The majority actually had 8 cycles because there was a response adapted approach to how long the treatment duration was. And so we've kind of questioned, well, if you're getting the same amount of durability and efficacy with a continuous therapy versus a time limited therapy, what's the potential advantage? Though the CR rate's going to be a little higher with this one. So again, probably more similar than different, just some nuances in terms of study design.
Martin, any comments, and particularly this issue of duration of treatment? In a couple of these, you have fixed duration, others are indefinite. Any thoughts about how that's going to play out moving forward?
Yeah, well, so these differences are really important, you know, practical differences. One is the duration of treatment. Is it for a fixed duration of time, maybe response adapted like mosunetuzumab, or is it until progression? Also the administration, whether it's intravenous or subcutaneous. And even it's only epcoritamab that's been developed as a subcutaneous only drug, but both mosunetuzumab and glofitamab, even though the first data that came out and the most solid data that we have are from IV use, they have both been developed for subcutaneous use as well. So these are really important differences, but I completely agree the similarities are the most important. I mean, if you look at, I completely agree also when looking at efficacy, they look pretty similar. We have the best and the largest set and the most mature data from mosunetuzumab. And even though perhaps you see slightly higher complete response rates with some of the others, this is not necessarily what you want to chase in a disease like follicular lymphoma. It shouldn't be at the expense of any significant added toxicity.
So, Loretta, you also talked about epcoritamab. This was in combination with R-squared, and we're seeing more and more combinations, and glofitamab in FL. Again, can you kind of put in perspective what we know about these two bispecifics in FL, and again, compared to the other two we just talked about?
I'll start with glofitamab. So one of the unique aspects is there's a lead-in with obinutuzumab in an attempt to sort of bind out some of that CD20 that might be in circulation. And we know obinutuzumab works for follicular, so maybe that might add to the efficacy that is observed specific to follicular lymphoma. I think one of the challenges with glofitamab is a point Martin just made. You know, we see reasonable efficacy with mosunetuzumab. What's going to be the attraction to a drug that's going to give you a little bit more toxicity? And so if the ease of use is not there in terms of you have that added obinutuzumab dose, which is, it can be done, but it's just one extra step that has to be considered. You might have to hospitalize these patients for toxicity monitoring. That's another sort of check in the lower attractive scale. And so I think the efficacy is going to be outweighed by the lower ease of use and the potential higher toxicity we see with glofitamab. It's probably not going to lend itself as easily to combination strategies. And so mosin, I think that's one major advantage, is the toxicity is so clean in a sense that you can combine it quite safely, most likely. Again, some of those studies are underway and we'll see the results. Epcoritamab, again, we've seen combination with lenalidomide and rituximab. So that's an interesting question. You know, you're adding rituximab and len, so it's a 3-drug combo as opposed to a 2-drug combo. So in practice, what is that going to look like? How are you going to get, you know, insurance approval? What is that going to look like from a scheduling standpoint? So again, some of these things will be fun to learn when we get clinical experience with it. But if the differences are going to be marginal, then I think the ease of use, the safety might outweigh the efficacy in follicular lymphoma.
So, you know, we're talking about mechanism of action, Martin, and I'm just trying to imagine the microenvironment when you put in mosunetuzumab and R-squared. Any speculation about what's actually going on when you do that?
And there's a lot of speculation. You know, when you add lenalidomide or any CELMoD or IMiD to to an immunotherapy, there are 100 suggestions on how this might or might not improve or worsen the outcomes. I've put a lot of patients on the epcoritamab and R-squared combination study, and I think there are two lessons. First of all patients respond. All my patients have had a CR. It's pretty impressive. They do come with the side effects of lenalidomide, which is not that attractive. They only get that for a year, fortunately. But the interesting thing is how rapidly that study included patients, mainly patients in second line. So it shows sort of an unmet need that I didn't realize was so large, that we really need something else for second line follicular lymphoma. And it even went so rapidly, as Loretta stated, that we still don't have the single agent phase 2 data in follicular lymphoma of EPCO. So we have the combination data coming out before the single agent. They will come hopefully at ASH, Loretta. So and they are looking good, I promise you. But it's interesting how I think these combinations do have a future, and particularly in the patients with rapidly the POD24 type patients, those with that respond only briefly to first line, even though they are fortunately quite rare.
So we talked about the fact that our primary target audience of our group is the general medical oncologist and community-based practice. Same docs are taking care of bladder cancer, breast cancer, and myeloma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Loretta, you know, it sounds like bispecifics are coming to that venue if they're not there now. I want to talk a little bit about cytokine release syndrome and some of your experiences, how you think it through. But first, can you just comment a little bit? I'd like to hear both of your thoughts about when and how general medical oncologists should be involved in delivering these agents. Can mosunetuzumab be used right now by a general medical oncologist from your point of view?
Yes, absolutely. Now, we learned, you have to generate order sets. And it's a little bit complicated to generate order sets that you're going to have conditional toxicity. It's not a guarantee. And the timing is often outside of the time the patient is in your hands. And so how do you give instructions for something that may or may not happen? How do you give instructions for something that may be very easy to manage with Tylenol versus it's going to escalate and need corticosteroids and or tocilizumab? Do you have to have tocilizumab on site? These are some of the challenges that we face as an institution because it's a brand new therapy for us and it's all outpatient where we don't have the infrastructure of our inpatient CAR T service to address this. And so I do encourage all the community oncologists to think about this, to gain access, put it into their pathways. There's a clear learning opportunity for how do we handle the unique toxicities because they're clearly manageable, but they're a little bit unpredictable, and it does require some education of staff and patients and caregivers.
So I was just flashing on a meeting we did not that long ago, just a few years ago, with the Florida Cancer Specialist, a group of general medical oncologists, and we were talking about HMA venetoclax and AML, and it had just been started to be reported, and they were like, we're going to be doing, first of all, are we going to be treating AML to start with, and second of all, we're really going to be giving it, of course, now, you know, no problem. So hope, you know, they get up to speed pretty quickly. Martin, what's your take on this? And what about this question of, do you need to have tocilizumab available in order to use these agents?
I think it will depend a little bit on the patient because, you know, there are, we've already at this point, both in indolent and aggressive lymphomas, identified some risk factors for development of serious or grade two or higher CRS. And they're not perfect markers of risk of CRS, but they are quite good, some of them. So I'd always have a few patients that I would pick out and say this patient needs to be, you know, perhaps even in hospital or at least within 30 minutes of the clinic. But I agree with Loretta that the majority of patients, particularly with mosunetuzumab, from what I've seen, and particularly with low burden disease, can be managed perfectly well in an outpatient setting. And you know, cytokine release syndrome is a relatively new phenomenon to most of us. And it requires, you know, education, and we all have a job either to educate each other or to learn. But you know, when you think about what we do with chemotherapy, with R-CHOP, for example, standard chemotherapy, which is given in any outpatient setting, we send these patients home with a risk that something might or might not happen within 5 or 19 days from now. And if they don't call when they have a fever, the consequences can be disastrous. Whereas CRS, even though I completely agree with Loretta, it can be a little unpredictable, but no way as unpredictable as, for example, neutropenia. So I think it's in a few years, cytokine release syndrome and the handling of what appears to be a phenomenon which is confined to cycle one in most cases will be everyday life for community oncologists. And then that has a lot of caveats. And there are some drugs, of course, that are probably more easy to put into private practice than others.
Yeah, actually, when I was talking about HMA venetoclax, and everybody's like, "Are you going to do ice?" Go, well, look, you all give FOLFIRINOX. If you can give FOLFIRINOX, you can do this. So, interesting comment in the or question in the chat room, Loretta from Kamal. Are there any trait training programs for nurses, as they're the ones who are, you know, triaging the cases? Of course, we go to the ONS meeting. We do a lot of nursing education, and we talk a lot about that. Any comments about how nurses fit into the equation, Loretta?
Yeah, they're a critical piece of the puzzle. And I do know that the companies they have a great force out that's available that can come and educate staff, and they're quite good. And I've participated in receiving a lot of that education, and I can tell you firsthand that they're helpful, and I would absolutely reach out to companies for that. The Lymphoma Research Foundation has partnered with a number of investigators that were involved across these studies and has also developed a guideline that I'm hoping will be in print soon that will also be of use to practices.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along here today. But actually, Hassan in the chat room asked the question that was the next question I was going to ask you. He wants to know what comes first, CAR T or bispecifics. But it's part of a more global question, Loretta, of where do you see bispecifics fitting in the sequence of therapy for FL? Can you comment on that?
I think for me in my practice right now, I'm using it in third line, and I'm using it in those patients that have had chemoimmunotherapy primarily front line and lenalidomide rituximab second line. And then I'm debating, do I use a CAR or bispecific? I usually will reserve the CAR for patients that I'm worried about transformation, and I'm going to prefer the bispecifics. It's a little bit more readily available. I do think Martin's right. The toxicity profile is much more favorable than CAR T, and so I'm going to use it probably much more frequently than I would CAR.
So another issue, and actually, Martin, I don't know if we're going to get to your case, actually has a patient who responded to a bispecific with a large B cell, but then a relapse, did not have CD20. So Martin, both in the setting of FL and I asked the same question, a diffuse large B cell, should we be measuring CD20 in patients who are about to get these drugs?
Yes, this is a short answer, because even though both in the studies of epcoritamab and glofitamab, we've had some PD analyses made that show no real difference in the chance of getting to a CR depending on different grades of CD20 expression. But generally, patients who do not express CD20 do not respond. So we don't want to waste patients' time. And they can still have CRS even if their disease is CD20 negative, because they're CD20 on healthy B cells, which can be enough to induce at least a low-grade CRS. Can I just answer quickly, Neil? You asked me a question before. I only answered part of it. Should there be tocilizumab in the treatment facility?
Right.
I think that yes, there should. The worst cases of cytokine release syndrome are the ones that happen very early. And the far worse are the ones where you see the first signs of CRS during infusion. This is IV antibodies I'm talking about. And these are and it's going to be so rare, but these are the ones where you don't want to miss the window of treating early. So I would always have tocilizumab ready, knowing very well that I would use it very rarely, during infusion or in the short observation, which is required afterwards.
Can I ask Martin a question?
Yeah, sure.
How do you distinguish CRS from infusion reaction?
That's a good question. A leading one. I don't. If you have an early, if you have an infusion-related reaction, it's probably an early CRS, and you don't want to miss an early CRS, so treat it as such. It's likely to be a bad one.
Yeah, the whole clinical approach to managing CRS is really interesting. We could talk a long time about it. Maybe we can get into it through some of these cases, though. Can you just sort of briefly overview what happened with this 54-year-old woman, Loretta?
Yeah, so young, fit patient, no real comorbidities, received frontline R-CHOP about 7 years ago at relapse, received bendamustine rituximab and is now relapsing second time 2 years after completion. Does have need of therapy, nothing bulky, so the largest lymph node's less than 7 centimeters, but not someone who's appropriate for observation. So two prior lines, both chemoimmunotherapy, young, fit patient. How would you approach this patient in third line?
So, Martin, how would you think through this situation? And, you know, if you had everything available, what would be your recommendation?
I would, and this is not only for the purpose of tonight's meeting, I would give a bispecific to this patient. And even in the presence of a lot of treatment options available for her.
Yeah, I mean, she hasn't had R-squared. Which bispecific, Martin?
Well, I've only had access to epcoritamab and glofitamab, but I would, you know, in the U.S. with approval of mosunetuzumab, I'd be perfectly happy with mosunetuzumab for this patient. And, you know, then if you're working in a specialized institution with access to clinical trials, you know, there might be combination studies that could be interesting, but she wouldn't necessarily need it.
So what happened with this patient, Loretta?
I agree. Yes. So this patient did receive mosunetuzumab. Did have cytokine release syndrome after the first cycle. It was very manageable. It was outpatient, not during the infusion, something that responded to Tylenol, has done well, has achieved a complete response still in the midst of therapy, but will I'll stop after 8 cycles as long as nothing else changes.
So could you talk specifically, though, about what happened when she got the cytokine release syndrome?
Yeah, I think there's a huge need for education. And so if we at least look at the data from the trial, after the first dose and third dose is when we tend to see most of the cytokine release syndrome, at least in terms of first onset. After the first dose, it's earlier, so about a median time of about 5 hours. And so that's exactly what happened. Patient received the infusion during the day. About 8, 9 p.m. that night, I get a phone call. And I do share my cell phone with patients who are getting this because I don't want them calling a triage nurse and being unfamiliar right now. You know, and we give them a prescription of dexamethasone to fill. And that's another reason why I just want them to call me so that I can walk them through, do you need it or not? And so we tried Tylenol. She wasn't feeling lightheaded or short of breath because you want to identify those who are going to have the higher grade. So hypotension, need for oxygen requirement. So that's always my first question. Do you feel faint? Do you feel lightheaded? Is your heart rate high? Do you feel short of breath? And if not, then we advise just take Tylenol. And if it resolves, perfect. We make sure they all have their temperature monitoring device and we have someone with them to help monitor them. One dose of Tylenol, everything was fine, no big deal. Now, because she had CRS with the first dose, when they come in for the second dose, we do a quick evaluation in the clinic by an APP or physician just to make sure we want to hospitalize them and monitor for that second dose, or do we still think it's appropriate for outpatient? So we did do her outpatient. If she'd had a more severe case, I would have hospitalized her and monitored for that second dose. She did fine with the second and third dose, no issue.
So again, just to get a little more into it, roughly how high was her temperature and how bad did she feel, so to speak? Was this sort of a mild thing or did she really felt bad?
This one was relatively mild. We'll talk about a second case, but generally it's kind of flu-like symptoms, a little fatigue, little myalgias, little headache. Temperature's usually 100 to 102. It's rare to be higher than that. Again, we generally have them take the Tylenol, check their temperature, make sure it recovers. You know, I've had situations where they take the Tylenol and the fever is still persisting. That'd be a little bit more worrisome than something that responds to one dose of Tylenol.
So without getting into all the details about this case, can you talk about what happened when this patient was treated and what the CRS was there and what you did about it?
Yeah, so it's an older gentleman, has some mild comorbidities, has had prior chemoimmunotherapy and lenalidomide rituximab, had a course of single agent rituximab, so a little bit gentler approach because of the fact he was older and a few more comorbidities. He did have good support because I think that's important. If we're going to do something where toxicity is going to happen after hours, we want to make sure that someone's there to place those phone calls and to follow instructions if we need them. So he did have toxicity again with the first dose. First dose was relatively mild, similar to the last case, some fever, some chills, responded to Tylenol, did well. Second dose did actually pretty well with the second dose, no issues. It was the third dose that got a couple phone calls. So the first phone call, he was having fever, a little bit more fatigue, not feeling quite as well. So this time, again, we tried the Tylenol within an hour, still having fever, still not feeling well, no shortness of breath, no lightheadedness. Wife was not particularly concerned, but with the persistence of the fever, then we actually did utilize the dexamethasone that we had prescribed. And so we generally will give them 4 milligram tablets. We gave eight, or I advised him to take 8 milligrams, so 2 tablets, and then reassess. And he actually did pretty good with that approach.
Martin, any comments on this case? You know, I'm thinking really a case-based approach where you really get into the granularity. I think that's going to be a really important thing. I'm learning a lot just hearing about these cases. Any comments, Martin?
Well, I think it's, great handling, of course, but also the approach that you take your experience from the priming dose and then individualize whether you hospitalize, how you pre-treat, if you advise the patient to be, for example, within 30 minutes of transport, if you don't hospitalize them, individualization based on the priming experience is really important and takes a bit of exercise as well.
So I'm just going to peruse a few of the results. We have tons of data from the survey, but just a couple of things that we asked that I think are interesting. You know, I think of these global questions because I know people in practice think about it. So Loretta, one thing we asked here was, how do you compare the, obviously it's indirect comparison, but we have to do it. In your mind, you know, when you look at the data, when you look at your experience, how do you compare efficacy and tolerability? We talked about sequencing as bispecific and CAR T. How do you compare efficacy? And, you know, looks like a lot of people think that at least in FL, efficacy is less with bispecifics, although, Martin thinks they're about the same, but I think everybody agrees that it's more tolerable. Any comments, Loretta?
I think the challenge is we just have longer follow-up with CAR, and it's a one-time infusion, so we can't unknow that, meaning we can't unknow the fact that axi-cel can result in a quite favorable PFS of about 40 months with a one-time infusion, whereas with mosun, it's about 24 months, with all the caveats if you can't really compare the two study populations. Now, if you think about the outcomes with tisa-cel, it's probably not much different than what we're seeing with mosun, for instance, similar CR rate, similar PFS. And so I think it's probably fair if you took all patients, including those that, you know, you may have considered for CAR but never took them to CAR because you're worried you weren't going to get them through the manufacturing, it's probably more similar than different in terms of efficacy.
So, Martin, I see that you think they're about the same in efficacy. And then this is really interesting. We asked the faculty, well, putting aside reimbursement issues, where do you think they should fit in? And you see a little heterogeneity there. Several people agree with the current placement of third line. But, Martin, you say maybe first line and beyond. Can you comment?
Yes. Yeah, so I realize that is perhaps a little bit over-enthusiastic. But when you can try and indirectly compare efficacy, which is, of course, impossible between studies and patient cohorts, I think there's one thing that we haven't answered yet, and this goes for CAR T and for the bispecifics as well. We've long regarded as a dogma almost follicular lymphoma as an incurable chronic disease. I think in the era of these immunotherapies, that dogma is going to fall. We will cure patients. And if I'm right, and that will, of course, wait to be seen, I think a proportion of patients, particularly the younger patients, we should consider these treatments in first line at some point, because we are going to cure follicular lymphoma with these treatments. We have to pick the right patients, pick the right immunotherapies, but at one point we have to get rid of life prolonging and disease slowing chemotherapy.
So Loretta, we call these surveys going beyond the guidelines. When we ask people, what do they do in their practice? So they all say the same thing. We call that a consensus. So when we talk about, you know, right now, a typical situation of BR up front, second line R squared, what's next? You can see a bispecific is kind of what people are thinking. Any comments, Loretta? I'm not going to go through any of the others, but I invite the audience to check these out now or when we send out the definitive program in terms of where these are should fit in right now. Or any situations where you think they should be used earlier than third line, assuming you could do that, Loretta?
I actually think this is quite remarkable to have all of these people have the same answer for follicular lymphoma. I think it just highlights that this is something we're quite enthusiastic about, and I think the efficacy looks to be quite good. I am optimistic it's going to move into earlier lines. I think we'll be questioning what's the optimal partner. Obvious one is lenalidomide, but I'm sure there'll be others that are explored. And so I'm just really eager to see how this all evolves.
I like the idea of curing follicular lymphoma. I haven't heard too much discussion about that in the past. All right, let's move over now, talk about diffuse large B-cell. And again, we're going to take the same kind of approach. Martin, I thought some of the slides you showed were very informative in trying to understand, you know, the differences between these agents. And the one thing in particular I thought was some of the laboratory data that you talked about. Can you comment on that?
Yes. So that is, I mean, we've talked about the absence of direct comparisons. This is actually a direct comparison. The problem is it's a direct comparison in preclinical models. So this is not human studies, but it's just, and also there's the reservation that this study was performed by the team behind epcoritamab, the preclinical team. So, but it's a comparison of the five CD3, CD20 antibodies, including plamotamab that we haven't mentioned yet. And what you see here is that the pharmacodynamic evidence of activity, which here is T-cell activation and T-cell-mediated cytotoxicity, seems to be reached at much, much lower levels. And these are logarithmic y-axes, much lower doses of EPCO and glofitamab than the three other drugs, pointing towards a higher potency of these drugs. Not necessarily that they are better, because you might just be able to give the other drugs in higher doses, but it kind of supports what at least I, with my subjective view, have seen in patients, which is that these are the two agents that are the most potent ones, at least in the aggressive lymphomas.
You know, kind of this whole thing is sort of reminding me, I don't know, you know, I actually wasn't around, I don't think around when chemotherapy first came out, but can you imagine chemotherapy first came out? They're just starting to figure out how it works. And now here we are, you know, whatever, 50 years later and so many complexities. I wonder if that's, you know, combinations, et cetera. You brought up the interesting idea of how do you get deeper and more durable responses, particularly the idea of combinations, Martin. Can you talk about that? And from your point of view, logically, what makes the most sense? One of the things that you commented on during your presentation that struck me was you're kind of like not so excited about combining with just classical chemotherapy, maybe more interested with antibody drug conjugate. What's your vision about how we can get more out of these agents, Martin?
So these are really early days, and it's like you say, it's tremendously interesting and thrilling even. The thing is with the bispecifics, the side effect profiles, which is really what determine combinability. And then in second line, it's mechanism of action and potential synergy. But the most important thing is, and this goes back to the development of chemotherapy combinations as well, it's the combinability of toxicity profiles. And when you look at the bispecifics, yes, they have a little bit of cytopenias occasionally, but not very much. It's cytokine release syndrome, which is important. And cytokine release syndrome looks very little like most of the toxicities of anti-cancer therapies that we use otherwise in lymphomas. Also, most other drugs have toxicity which is develops in a cumulative fashion. It gets worse and worse, or at least it stays with time. I mean, if you give a kinase inhibitor to a patient and they get diarrhea, they usually keep that diarrhea if you stay with the same dose, right? Whereas with the bispecifics, most of the CRS is over after 3-4 weeks, which means that both in the nature of the side effects, but also the dynamics of the side effects, you can combine them with practically everything, I would say, which also opens the problem that you have to combine them with everything, and it's very confusing. And there are so many studies ongoing, and I participate in some of the chemo combinations as well. And I'm not antagonistic directly. I just do not think that if you have something which depends very heavily on the fitness of T cells, such as bispecifics, it's not overly elegant to combine them with very large doses of steroids, for example, with R-CHOP, or with cyclophosphamide or bendamustine, even though I've given bispecifics successfully right in the aftermath of bendamustine treatment. But theoretically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And if you really want to dive down deeply, I think the most interesting partners are the ones that directly support the mechanism of action and perhaps even try and meet some of the shortcomings of the bispecific. Loretta mentioned the possibility of exhaustion of T cells, which is probably a mechanism of loss of response in some of these patients. So if you can combine with drugs that extend the fitness of the T cells and hence extend and perhaps make permanent the responses, that would be fantastic. We're doing that in a number of studies. And the great news so far is that we see practically no added toxicity. And that's the first point.
And Loretta, that brings up another issue, and it relates not just to bispecifics, but also CAR T. And sometimes I wonder if we emphasize this enough. And Martin talking about the toxicities reminded me of this, which is susceptibility to infection. Martin is going to present a case, if we get to it, of a patient who got COVID and the issue of response to vaccination. Can you kind of provide an overview of what we know about infectious complications of bispecifics and how they compare to what you see with CAR T?
Yes, so we have to recognize that we're talking about CD20 bispecifics here. And so you're depleting B cells and you're chronically stimulating T cells. And so, again, I think it depends on the duration of treatment, how heavily pretreated patients are. We see neutropenia as well as a not infrequent toxicity. So I do think it's sort of a combination of all those factors. We tend to treat older patients because we view this as more favorably tolerated than CAR T. And so in general, I think infection is something you absolutely have to be mindful of, and particularly viral infections. Fortunately, in my experience, I've not seen a lot of febrile neutropenia, despite about 24% of the patients around that ballpark experiencing grade 3 or higher neutropenia. I have seen quite a bit of viral infections. And so I think it's just something, again, education, educating the staff, educating the patient, and just making sure that they're up to date on all their prophylaxis. We do shingles prophylaxis, for instance, in these patients. And oftentimes we talk about PJP prophylaxis as well. And so I think it's just a little bit different situation than what we've done with chemotherapy in the past.
Martin, anything you want to add on to that? Any practical, you talked about educating patients and the staff, any practical issues that come up in the management of these patients? How often do you see cytopenias?
So we see the cytopenias that Loretta mentioned. We see occasional thrombocytopenias. Neutropenias are quite common. They are as unpredictable as the ones we see after rituximab, like the late onset ones, typically, after several months of treatment. Some of the patients have neutropenia after every treatment, and they can be, managed well with G-CSF. The most important thing is definitely the lymphodepletion. And, in part as a testament of the efficacy of the drugs, many of the patients stay on treatment for a long time and they stay in nice remission afterwards. We see the consequences of prolonged B-cell suppression. They do, they have a very hard time, for example, clearing a COVID infection. Some of them have, positive COVID tests and even dry cough and symptoms for more than half a year. And this is a challenge, and it's a challenge that, you can also turn it around and say it's quite impressive that most of these studies have been carried out mainly during the COVID era. The phase 2 data that we're looking at in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma has been generated entirely in the COVID era, and yet we see quite few cases of treatment discontinuation, but the majority of cases of discontinuations due to side effects, in my experience, is due to viral infections, mainly COVID. And yeah, just another point, if I may, Neil, I think it's very important that to monitor both patients on treatment, but also patients who've finished treatment who will stay in depletion for, several months or even a few years, that we monitor their IgG levels, monitor them clinically, and be quite liberal with immunoglobulin substitution. That's at least what I do on top of what Loretta already said, which is antiviral prophylaxis. And we give PJP prophylaxis to most of our patients as well.
No, I was just flashing on, you know, when COVID first came out, and one of the key questions was, are we going to be able to do clinical research? How are you going to get it done? Really amazing that things just kept moving forward. We could talk a long time about all the different combinations that are being looked at, as always happens in oncology. But I want to ask you about one in particular, Martin, that you were very much involved with, which was kind of interesting, the idea of combining a bispecific with an antibody-drug conjugate. In this case, polatuzumab, but we're seeing so many antibody-drug conjugates coming out in oncology. What did you see in this study? I mean, both of these are now approved agents. Would you give it right now?
Oh, yes, definitely. So this combination is the combination of glofitamab and polatuzumab. So it's actually not one of the combination where I believe the drugs directly support each other's mechanism of action, but they have practically no overlapping toxicity apart from some of the cytopenias. That's very manageable. And actually, this slide is data that I presented at ASH last year. We updated that recently at the summer conferences, and we've included more than 100 patients, and we still keep seeing around 80% overall response and 60% complete responses, even in patients with high-grade lymphomas, which are typically quite difficult to treat. So this is a really neat combination, and it's something which I strongly hope and believe will be developed, particularly in the very aggressive lymphoma space, such as high grade.
So, Loretta, any comment about all these trials going on with combinations, and any favorite strategies that you have or thinking about?
Particularly in large cell, you're going to see more combinations with frontline chemoimmunotherapy. And I shared Martin's comments or thoughts earlier. I'm less attracted to that approach. That being said, wouldn't be surprised if we saw high efficacy. And so I think that's just maybe one area. It's a little bit different than follicular. We're going to see an attraction to more cytoreductive approaches in combination with these, just because of the nature of the disease. But I look forward to, you know, combinations where the toxicity is not going to be impacted. It's not going to be complicated. And so I think the polatuzumab was really intriguing for that in that regard.
So here's a question. You know, you go through all the data in your talk, and I really recommend people check that out for the various bispecifics in diffuse large B-cell. But without, you know, kind of using slides, can you just sort of talk about your vision of the activity and efficacy of the available agents and how you differentiate them, Martin?
So the phase two studies of glofitamab and epcoritamab in large cell lymphomas, they are practically identical. When you look at numbers of patients, their characteristics, their response rates, and their complete response rates. And even if you look at toxicity, which again is dominated by cytokine release syndrome, they have slightly different profiles, but over and all, the severity is pretty much on par. So they are very comparable, even though they, of course, have not been directly compared. Mosunetuzumab in the aggressive lymphomas, in my eyes, stand out as weaker. They have lower response rates. They also have less toxicity and can be given in an outpatient setting. So I'm not saying that mosunetuzumab should not be used in large cell lymphomas, but they seem to be less efficacious. And odronextamab, from the data that we have so far, which is limited, probably is somewhere in between. We have to look at odronextamab and realize that it has to be given at quite high doses in order to reach an efficacy which is comparable to EPCO and Glofit. So maybe it's a weaker one, but it's manageable after the changes to the step-up regimen that Loretta mentioned, which was also in place in large cell lymphoma. So a bit early to call, but I would place my bet on epcoritamab and glofitamab. And honestly, I don't have a favorite.
Any comments, Loretta?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, sometimes there's going to be patient-specific features that are going to tip us one way or the other. I think the subcutaneous administration is intriguing in a lot of ways because it's less time potentially in our center. And so for that reason, that might be something that is more attractive in the large cell space.
What about one this issue, Loretta? Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
That's just one thing that's really important is also the duration of treatment. And if you look at duration of treatment and durability of responses and I don't think it's necessary to give epcoritamab until progression, to be honest. I think it's really a mistake that we do so. You give glofitamab for a maximum of 12 cycles, which is like 8 months. And if you look at the durability of the complete responses, which have the same frequency in these two phase two studies, the durability of CR actually is at least as good, probably a little bit longer with glofitamab, even though it's an indirect comparison. And that is for a treatment which is fixed to 8 months, as opposed to something that goes on. So I completely agree. Sub-Q is attractive. So is fixed duration. Mm-hmm.
So here's another sort of global question. We'll start out with FL. I ask you, Loretta, which is the issue of, and we were talking about the hope for cure, the issue of plateau. To what extent do we see a plateau with bispecifics with the hope that maybe this is going to turn out to be a cure? And how do you compare that to CAR T in bispecific, in follicular, again, in terms of plateau, Loretta?
I think in both regards, those patients who achieve a complete response, the majority of those patients actually do very well. So though you don't see the traditional plateauing of the curve like we see with CAR and large cell lymphoma, even in follicular, you don't really see that. But if you just follow those patients out who are in a CR, even with Mosin, I mean, those curves look really, really attractive, particularly for this population of patients that was studied on the phase two, because they were patients that were enriched with refractoriness to chemoimmunotherapy. And so those curves to me are super attractive. So that's where we're kind of focusing our attention. Can you identify who those patients are going to be that are more likely to achieve a CR? Because those are probably the ones that you can potentially cure.
And of course, we don't have as much follow-up as we do with CAR T at this point. What about diffuse large B cell, Martin? Again, plateau with CAR T as opposed versus plateau with bispecific, specifically EPCO and Glofit.
Yeah, so I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that patients are cured with CAR T, and I think most people would agree with that. The difference between the plateau with the bispecifics, EPCO and Glofit particularly, is that we have less follow-up. And we keep maturing the data, and we keep getting data from new studies. We'll update data from the phase two studies of EPCO and Glofit soon again. And we are seeing clear plateaus. So I have no doubt in my mind that we are curing patients. Whether we are curing as many patients as with CAR T, I'm not sure, to be honest. But getting to a CR is the crucial thing. If you're in a CR, you're very, very likely to stay in that CR for an extended period of time. And, you know, with these patients who have been refined as much as they have to get into these studies, you would seeing a CR lasting without any intervening treatment for 2 years or more is not a guarantee of cure, but it's a pretty strong hint in my eyes.
How about this question, Martin? This is a simple one, just kidding. Based on what we know right now, at this point in time, again, putting aside reimbursement, et cetera, when do you think is the optimal time to introduce, let's say, Glofit or EPCO in a patient with diffuse large B cell? And which one? Any preference?
Yeah, so in... First-line treatment for DLBCL, even though criticized and often challenged, works pretty well in many patients. So I would say second-line. I think that would be the best way. But this is in the absence of CAR-T. If you have a CAR-T, I think the natural place for CAR-T is second-line in large B-cell lymphoma. So I'd have to say third-line. Having said that, of course, is, again, I advertise the combinability of the bispecifics, and I know that they will be perfect partners to incorporate in first line. It's already being done in several studies. And whether it's the best bang for your buck, I don't know. Whether it's the best way to use these bispecifics, I'm not sure. But it has to be done, and it is being done. So it's, I would say, first or third line for the bispecifics. Second line, so far reserved for CAR-Ts. With novel combinations, that may change.
Any comments on that, Loretta, and particularly the issue of what comes first, CAR T or bispecific, particularly the patient who's very ill and needs a response?
I absolutely agree with Martin's thoughts. I think where I've struggled a little bit are those patients with primary refractory disease that we're trying to get through the manufacturing period of an auto CAR. You know, it'd be intriguing to see, you know, if you could stabilize them with the bispecific since it's off the shelf. The one caveat to that, though, is you still have to do the dose ramp up. So though you can see activity with the first dose, you're not going to really get to full dose till about 3 weeks in. And that's probably as long as it's going to take to manufacture. But I still think that's an unmet need. And then for those frail elderly frontline patients that are not appropriate or can't tolerate an anthracycline, it'd be really interesting to see how the bispecifics do in that space, other than just single agent mosun.
So a little bit from the survey related to diffuse large B-cell. We asked the same question we did with FL, comparing it. We've just been talking about this to CAR T. Almost the consensus, except for Martin, who thinks their efficacy is about the same. Everybody else thinks that maybe CAR T is a little more effective and that bispecifics are better tolerated. We were just talking about this again, a little bit of heterogeneity and where people, you heard Martin describe his thoughts about where this might fit in, and you can see everything from first to third line therapy. We asked about a patient who has no significant comorbidities, a younger patient, what comes first? Everybody says CAR T. I want to actually get into a couple of your cases, Martin, and particularly this first case. If I can, let me see if I can find it here. Let's see here. Yeah. There you go. Well, is this it? Hold on. Sorry. Oh, yeah, no, sorry. All right, yeah, this one. This is an amazing case. So maybe we can end on this. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to the 76-year-old woman, Martin?
Yeah, so she'd had CLL for more than 20 years and you know, been treated over and over again, five prior treatment lines, responded to all of them, and then she had a Richter transformation, which is not a great news for a 76-year-old, and it was with a relatively aggressive presentation at the time of the first transformation. She had three lines of treatment, R-CHOP, R-BENDA, which is not great, R-GEMOX, didn't respond to any of it, actually progressed right through everything and was really sick, as you can see on the baseline imaging on the right, when she came for experimental treatment, which was really her last hope. And she responded dramatically to the induction with glofitamab. You can see already after two cycles, she was in a complete response. She had a rough ride to that complete response. She had a high-grade cytokine release syndrome. She needed time in the ICU, mechanical ventilation, dual presses. But she came out perfectly well and got her second treatment on time, actually. She did progress during treatment. I think it was after eight cycles. She had progressive disease. We biopsied her site of progressive disease, which was a single site. That site, the cells had lost CD20, and we see that over and over again, pointing towards a potential mechanism of resistance, but also, in my eyes, pointing towards the need of combining, at least in some patients with some diseases, the bispecifics with drugs that target other things than CD20.
So I just noticed something that I didn't when you first presented the case. When she got the glofitamab, August 2020, those were scary days. That was before the vaccines came out. August 2020, not a good summer. And here this lady's in the ICU, intubated, and yet she has a CR. What an amazing story.
You asked about the temperature before, and I remember her temperature still. It was 40.8, and in Fahrenheit, I believe that's 105.5.
Yeah, and you were talking before that she was not a happy camper at that point, expressing her displeasure to you about CRS.
She used her middle finger when I came to the ICU. But she was happier later on.
Well, it shows a little spunkiness and maybe says how she got through all this. One of the things I thought was really interesting, I'm curious, Loretta, your experience with this. You know, the concern about flare and the fact that she actually had a prophylactic trach done because of the concern, because of this huge mass compressing the trachea. And I think another case, I think it was one of your cases, Martin, the patient had pain in the site of tumor. Do you see the tumors, you know, increasing in size? How often do you see that happen? Sort of a physical flare, Loretta. And do you ever see patients who get pain in the site of their cancers?
Yes. And I think, again, it speaks to the fact we have to educate our patients and our caregivers, because they can be quite alarmed about masses increasing in size. And so just making sure, you know, recognize this clearly can happen. I mean, we've seen it with lenalidomide-based treatment. I've seen it with CAR T. It's no surprise to see it with these. And you're probably going to see it early on in the first few weeks.
But do you actually see pain? Do people complain of pain? And is that because it's getting necrosed or because it's getting bigger? What do they tell you?
Yeah, I've definitely heard about pain, and I've seen it physically increasing in size over the span of 24 hours. And I do think it's probably infiltration. It's probably stretching those capsules if they still exist. So it's probably a combination of all those factors.
So Loretta and Martin, thank you so much. We could talk all day long about this. It's such an exciting area. Audience, thank you for attending. I'll talk next Tuesday about pancreatic cancer. We're keeping our fingers crossed that someday we'll have agents like what we've just been talking about here in the lymphomas with the pancreatic and many other solid tumors. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Loretta. Thanks, Martin.